Hi, can you hear me? Well, great. Just take a drink. I'm going to talk a little bit about alternate ideas of history and then show some slides to you. Over the course of three chilly days in November of 1988, 80 photographic curators convened to chat, to share some insider information, and to gossip at a plush conference center in Westchester County, New York. The assembly marked the fifth annual convocation of the picture professional group that is called, without a trace of irony, Oracle. But, as anyone who keeps tabs on what museums admit to their collections as photographic art might suspect, few conferees showed any signs of prescience. Maybe at odd moments on racquetball courts or late at night around the open bar, the curious nature, history, and future of the photographic representation was discussed. But most participants were preoccupied with the organization and the reorganization of the past. What seemed to bind these custodians of art collections, national archives, and historical societies together was an interest in trading housekeeping tips. They were the guardians of the institutional photographic file cabinets, and in their minds, a very small cross-section of the millions of photographs made needed to be saved, cared for, kept in their place. They were just doing their jobs, trying to make order out of a photographic world that's just too big to contain. This year, as we all know, marked the sesquicentennial of Daguerre's announcement of photography's invention, and at Oracle, 2 years ago, birthday plans were already well underway. Internationally, museums were planning to parade out their 19th century jewels, their Westons, the Joel Peter Witkins. And this year, we've seen the art of the still photograph as art reaffirmed yet again. But hold on to your noisemakers, because if the history of photography has gotten to be just a little bit boring, it's not the medium's fault. It's the problem of the curators who cater the sesquicentennial festivities, who never cut the birthday cake of photography into big enough slices, who won't serve up our most deeply felt photographic experiences along with the birthday cake. Since 1839, mutations in technology, world economies, political practices, and social record keepings have encouraged the photographic image to seep into every fissure of our contemporary existence. Life begins with a sonogram and all too often ends under the glow of a rented television set in a hospital room. In between these life and death photographic opportunities, the living frequent movies, rent videos, take Polaroids, consume thousands of magazines and newspapers, get their teeth x-rayed, and every once in a while go to a museum. If we are going to celebrate photography, let us, in this birthday year, begin to consider the medium's truer history in our lives and its true and overwhelming importance in the culture. The real history of photography lies somewhere beyond the borders of institutional curatorial taste. The pictures that nourish us, seduce us, express our feelings, and document our lives won't be found on museum walls. The more Catholic the photographic medium has become, the more parochial the institutional response has been. Museum design collections may exhibit Tupperware, but they're always sure to throw the food away first. In the exhibition of photography, separating the form from the content has proven to be even more difficult. So let's not worry so much about photography being an art. It's more useful to think about photography as a language rich in dialects, and to think of its history as reflecting the ongoing input of multiple authorship. If we're going to limit ourselves to paying respect to the still photograph, forgetting that film, television, and video image might just as well be considered photographic as well, we should look beyond the acid-free storage boxes that rest on the museum shelves. The more generous overview of photography sits in shoeboxes, government warehouses, corporate basements, newspaper files, and in obscure archives. That's where you'll find the images that not only exhibit all the hallmarks of art, form, content, expression, but can suggest the importance of photography to our lives. This is not a postmodern approach to photography. Berenice Abbott paid attention to file cabinets and, as a result, salvaged Atchey. Photographers, artists, writers, picture editors, historians, curators, and other mildly curious people have long researched their way through unexplored genre pictures, reveling in multiple photographic realities. But in recent years, it's become a shared belief that photographs not only describe our condition, but have come to precondition our condition. And the archaeological approach to the medium not only salvages our past, but helps us through the present. Beauty, truth, and compelling fiction turn up in the most unusual of places. John Sarkowski found that out when he organized the exhibition From the Picture Press in 1973, working with Diane Arbus on photo research and after her death with Carol Kaczmarek. In prowling through photographic morgues of newspapers, terrific images began to fall into categories that soon made themselves evident. Celebrities, political leaders, beauty contest winners, disaster sites, crime scenes, gag pictures. Newspaper pictures, aided by captions, quickly explained themselves and upon examination made their picture strategies evident. A much more radical tactic was used a few years later by the artists Larry Sultan and Mike Mandel in editing pictures for their remarkable book, Evidence, published in 1977. From the files of municipal archives, state and federal agencies, manufacturers, and research facilities, indecipherable images, never intended for public consumption, were sequenced into a loose and spacey narrative. Once Sultan and Mandel stripped them of their explanatory captions, photographs documenting mysterious industrial procedures, equipment tests, and accidents became quite surreal. The believable looked unbelievable, and fact slid right into fiction, an idea that was informing the work of a number of artists at that time, among them Richard Prince. You could see an earnest image turn comic. You learned that the photographic intention was fragile and could easily be short-circuited. The next step was to suggest how disbelief could be willfully overridden, an idea that Diane Keaton and I considered when we scavenged archives in New York and Los Angeles, searching out the exaggerated Hollywood color publicity photographs that were included in the book Still Life. In the fake candid shots of movie stars and in stiffly posed production stills, audiences found reality in the photographic gray area where propaganda, entertainment, and personal memory overlapped. This is probably a good time to just cruise through some of the slides from Still Life. This project started in about 1981. It was a time when, in galleries, you were just starting to see the work of the generation of artists that have, I guess, been called the appropriationists or the image scavengers. Cindy Sherman, Richard Prince, Sherry Levine, a whole group of people who started really questioning the whole nature of representation in photography. At the time I was working at Castelli Gallery, it was my job to sell art photographs and promote art and photography, and it seemed like the avenues and questions that were being asked by these this group of artists was very interesting. At the time, also, one of what seems to be an unending series of books about Hollywood and glamour pictures had come out. It was called Hollywood Color Portraits, and it was about 50 or 60 really dull studio shots of movie stars dragged into a photographer's studio and sat kind of Richard Avedon-like in front of a piece of colored seamless. So Keaton and I thought there's got to be something else out there and started going around to movie studios who were helpful only because the movie Reds was about to open up. It was a $35 million movie and the star of the movie was asking Paramount for a favor and they did it. So they led us into a storage room across the street from Lincoln Center and we started going through what literally was the dreck of studio and Hollywood photography. This was the material that had not been stolen by the collectors who hoard these things and trade them on a black market. These were things that hadn't been thrown out because they took up a lot of room. This was just the junk. And we spent 2 years going from studio to studio finding whatever we could find of the earliest publicity photography. These were made on the sets of productions. They were shot by still photographers who were loathed, absolutely loathed in the course of producing movies. After a shot was filmed, the studio photographer in most cases would drag in an 8x10 camera or a 4x5 camera. The director would just walk off and this poor person would have to deal with whatever lighting, scenery, and personnel conditions he had. The practice of color photography started largely after 1942 when magazines started reproducing this material and would send them out to magazines in hopes that they would get reproduced. So I'm just going to cruise through these. There's a couple of very evident genres that you'll see as we go through them. The first picture is a very late one. It's from about 1960. It's from the TV show of National Velvet that was a ripoff of the movie National Velvet. So you get someone who's supposed to look like Liz Taylor. It seemed to be a great little metaphor about our use of goods in photography. Everybody's very happy with their objects, but they're all staring off into space in completely different directions. The very bottom. Okay. This is from a movie, it happened at the World's Fair. It's Elvis Presley on a supposed date. He's supposed to be on top of the Space Needle. that is supposed to be Mount Rainier in the background, and everybody's supposed to be having some fun. This is the kind of shot that would be probably not sent out because it reveals too much about the process and the mystique and mystery. This is obviously a picture that never got sent out and never got stolen. This is Dana Andrews and his family seated at home. It's a perfect mannerist family portrait. This is the one photograph that I was sure we would be sued for, because I thought if I were one of those kids, I'd sue. You know, it's interesting because Dad's the movie star, Dad's comfortable, Dad's smiling. Everyone else looks like a functional retardate at best. And it's a remarkable picture, and just sat around in the files because nobody had the sense to throw it out. This is from a movie called, The View from Pompeii's Head. We didn't see a lot of these movies. We had never seen them. We didn't care whether we had seen them or not. We were interested in finding the pictures that were the most artificial, that did the most convincing job of teaching America what America was about. And this one purported to be, sometimes these, if we were lucky, we would find the original captions that were sent out with these photographs. This one did have a caption and explained that this was a family argument between husband and wife. The argument around involved his Southern sensibility. That's all we knew about it. What we were interested in is what it sets up as the typical family situation. You get mom having a very, very difficult emotional time on a piece of tape on the floor, because that's where she's supposed to be standing. You get Stephen Boyd as dad holding a little girl who's like a Shirley Temple lookalike, as if she were a volleyball. And it's a very volatile scene. Also, the furniture that's in this picture turns up in other pictures. Things get recycled and recycled and recycled. We started looking at the pictures, and not only are they interesting for, you know, constructions of social roles and gender roles, there's great histories of decor and art in all of these pictures kind of buried in the background. You're right. I take it back. Okay, this is Anne Blythe moving into her new home in 1953, a period when television is getting very popular and the Hollywood publicists are doing everything they possibly can to make movie stars be attractive to a normal populace. It looks like the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It's really hard to believe that that's how movie stars live. There's a frightening resemblance between Anne Blythe and Mary Boone, for those of you who know Mary Boone. And you'll see in other pictures of Anne Blythe that her smile stays the same no matter what's happening to her. This is, I think of this picture as the history of lapels and the history of how you can fold pocket handkerchiefs, which is something I've never been able to do. It's from a movie called Woman's World, in which four guys are all competing for the same executive position and bring their wives to a big city, and you know, somebody gets the job. The thing that's great about this also, to me, is in the same sense of world's fairs always projecting an image of a future, here's the movie's not only telling you what the present is about, but what the future's about. And I'd still like to see the cars that are on the wall. It's another one of those promises that never comes through. Scary picture. This is a movie called A Private's Affair. It's probably as Arbusy as you'll get in this bunch. These are supposed to be happy young people on their way to the beach. The beach is indoors. The beach has a seam in the back. Everybody's feet are dirty. Everybody's a little bit pudgier than you would think that movie stars would be. You've got one of the Crosby Boys. You have Barbara Eden. You have Sal Mineo. Stepping off into an existential void. Speaking of existential voids, who is this? God, does anybody remember the name of this guy I'm blanking on? He had a TV show called Run for Your Life. It's Ben Gazzara, right. This was an uncredited appearance by Ben Gazzara in a Jerry Lewis movie called Big Mouth. And at the beginning of his TV show, the Run for Your Life, he was seen running behind these hedges, and on that wall behind him on a cyclorama would be projected scenes from one place or another. But here it's truly, you know, the myth of Sisyphus. It's a guy with an ascot running and running and running and running. This gives you a little clue about American taste. Hollywood movies are notoriously about 10 years behind reality. This is a mid-1960s set that has replicated a perfect kind of ersatz 1950s environment. There's a fake Klein painting on the wall. There's fake Giacometti's. There's fake Calder's. There's drinks enough for an army of people and carpeting that looks as if the army had just walked through. This is where Cindy Sherman starts to creep in. And this is Diane McBain, kind of as Cindy Sherman, as a lovelorn young woman sitting in her wood-paneled home eating chocolates. Here's one of the constructions. This is one of my favorites, yeah. This is. This is obviously from South Pacific. It's Rosanna Brazzi. It was one of the interesting experiences to find this transparency. These things, many of the times we found original color transparencies that we just walked out of the studios with. Nobody ever kept lists. Nobody cared that we had these things. If we were looking at transparencies, they'd say, hey, you want to take some old posters? I mean, Hollywood presents a very interesting model for how people treat their photographic histories. The history of Hollywood is very much a part of our image history. And at the times that these movies were made, no one had any sense that this material would have any value at all in any way at all. It was before videotapes were being made. And these movies were dead meat about 2 weeks after they were done, so these things all got thrown out. What's become ironic now is that when movie studios re-release something, like if South Pacific were to be re-released, and whichever studio it was that produced the movie, distributed the movie, needed to find the publicity materials, they would have to go rent it from a private collector, who more than likely would be a vice president of their own corporation who saved this stuff from the heap. Anyway, this was a great picture. It was an 8x10 color transparency that was so detailed that you could see every hair on Rosanna Brazzi's head, and you could see every blade of grass, and you could see every pebble through Mitzi Gaynor's face. But it's a very remarkable image of longing and love. It's just another great archetypal family picture. It's from a movie called Bigger Than Life that was so controversial at the time that James Mason had to find the money to do it himself. It was about a school teacher who took massive doses of cortisone and as a result went nuts and terrorized his students at school and his family at home. But it's kind of a beautiful classic Hollywood picture with the big scary shadows and, you know, the intense expressions. More teenagers, more old teenagers. This one was very odd because it's one of the few pictures that I really couldn't tell whether it was photographed outdoors or indoors. It's if it is indoors, if in fact that is a rear screen projection, it's a really good job, as is the spilled Coke and the oozing cheeseburgers and the teeth. We thought that this was propaganda when we found it, you know, but it wasn't. It wasn't. This is not Esther Williams. It's Ruth Roman, and the picture is from the 1950s. So maybe it's Korean War propaganda. It's kind of it's another one of those pictures that remind you about the weird parts of being in the movies, about what it's like to stand, you know, up to your neck in water in waterproof makeup, you know, holding up a battleship for a photograph. There's a certain amount of humiliation in these pictures that is interesting to take a look at. Well, this is real life. This is real life. This is a fashion fitting for something like Movie Star magazine. God, I'm forgetting her name too. Yeah. Anyway, this really isn't her home. That really is a Modigliani painting on the wall. That really is her stomach pushing out of the dress. Those really are the veins of her feet popping out of her open-toed shoes, and this is kind of the reality that somehow could sneak out in a picture like sneak out in a picture like this and not get out in a publicity shot. Yeah. Okay, more home life. This is Betty Hutton at home with her husband. I didn't believe it was home. Somebody assured me that this was Brentwood in Los Angeles, that people in Brentwood really did have homes like that. I didn't believe that movie stars sat on vinyl furniture. I didn't believe that movie stars drank at breakfast. I didn't believe that they did crossword puzzles. It's kind of a wonderful, wonderful picture about this artificial reality. These were widely circulated to magazines and reproduced constantly. Okay, this is the best of the Cindy Sherman genre. This is Jane Russell in a movie called The Fuzzy Pink Nightgown. It's after Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. She's getting a little bit older. They're trying to keep her a sex star, so they slap this really unbelievable wig on her. They put makeup on the hand that's closest to the camera to cover the liver spots, but forget the other hand. They forget to take the Band-Aids off her toes. And people thought she was hot. It's another one of those tirelessly interesting and kind of stupid publicity pictures. This is Dolores Gray, who collected poodles. The thing I never have understood about this picture is, where is this picture? Is she going by the world's biggest staircase? I have no idea. And also, the thing I love about this is she's about an eighth of an inch thick. There's no picture where the idea of image is so clear as in this. Oh, it's more family life. This is from Parrish. Troy Donahue is the rich boy. Connie Stevens brings him home to the poor family's house. And what do poor people do? They wear polka dot clothes and they drink beer and they watch television. This is another supposed real-life situation. This is a dinner party in somebody's home. Polly Bergen is at dinner. It's Jane Powell's house. And Jane Powell seems to be wearing the same dress that Grandma wore in the last picture. Another polka dot dress. It's another picture that's hard to fathom. It's an at-home shot. It's purported reality. Why do movie stars not have windows in their homes? Why do movie stars eat cottage cheese and milk for dinner? You know, why is there a woman in the upper left-hand corner shining a light on this table? It's Mary Boone. Ah, more love. It's love and art intermixing. Jane Fonda, Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. in The Chapman Report, one of those scandalous sex movies from the early 60s. It's kind of poignant to look at this because of Jane Fonda's career. And to me, it's interesting. I live in the Garment Center in Manhattan. That's where my loft is. And there's something that's called a garmento tan, which is what happens when people from the clothing industry go to Florida for the weekend and come back the color that Ephraim Zimbalist has turned in this old faded transparency. This was as natural as it got. It's Lassie in her last feature film, standing on AstroTurf, with a very thin line of spittle coming out of her mouth, but it's hard to see in the slide. A picture that gets painfully close to life. It's from a movie called X-15. It's Charles Bronson. It's Stanley Holloway, the kid from My Three Sons. Awfully reminiscent of those scenes where you were dragged outside the house and made to stand facing the sun for this fantastic photographic moment. It's an oddball one, only because it's as close to the Parthenon frieze as we could find. It's a very classical costume session. June Haver is going over some costume sketches. It's a weird one. This is Ingrid Bergman. And this was a publicity picture that was, this did come with a very long caption. It was the cameraman's birthday on a movie she was making. She was angry at the cameraman, insisting that all he did was photograph her shadow. And so she presented him with her shadow for his birthday. With a note saying, "May my shadow always follow you." Kind of morbid, this picture. Speaking of public art, this is Henry Moore. This is like a Henry Moore sculpture. It's Frankie and Annette on the beach in the wind without a hair being stirred by anything. This is Ray Milland and the Man with the X-ray Eyes. Another humiliating one. This is Elvis Presley in a Sandy Scogan picture. This is called Easy Come, Easy Go. Doesn't look too happy either, Elvis. Our former president and his first wife lounging on their Hollywood poolside deck waiting to be beamed up to space. This is a nice one too because you can see welt marks on Jane Wyman's legs. Obviously she's just flipped over to get sun on the other side and she's kind of marked up. The last picture I'll show you from Still Life is a really odd one that we found, and we were really unable to figure out what it was from. There were very, very few women directors in Hollywood during this time, but it certainly gives you some indication about the nature of reality levels in a lot of the photographs we look at. We can look at this, and I'll just finish up this part. The kind of narrations we can attach to photographs might be thought of as being either deductive or inductive. In the book Exhibition Projects Describe, pictures were edited down from larger photographic inventories to reveal the mechanisms that allowed each picture genre to communicate. From the clues you uncover, you solve the crime. There's another way to use pictures, as Steichen proved when he organized The Family of Man in 1955. He not only dealt out the photographic cards, he was playing with a marked deck. In this approach, photography is used, quite literally, as language. Images are utilized as words or phrases or sentences or paragraphs in some grander linguistic scenario. Photographs and photographers' intentions are manipulated into servicing another idea. The picture editor becomes, in a sense, an author. What Steichen chose not to do, continuing with the card metaphor, was show his hand. While the photography community discredited his achievement and called his bluff, the larger audiences didn't. The Family of Man was a huge popular success. Its worldwide tour was sponsored by the U.S. Information Agency as a Cold War propaganda tool. The art of photography was not what was being championed by Steichen, probably. It's more likely that he was proving the world trust in the messages that could be broadcast by photography. Maybe he was simply exercising shrewd showmanship. Maybe he was just giving form to some irrepressible optimism that exists in all of us, which might explain the remarkable success 30 years later of a book called A Day in the Life of America. Since the 1950s, however, a growing connoisseurship of photographic disinformation has coated Steichen's communicative tactics with a heavy dusting of saccharin. We now catalog the tricks and white lies of photography while we attempt to exact its truths. In a sense, it makes for a richer, impacted, complicated photographic storytelling. If you use a remote control unit to vault yourself from one channel to the next, or enjoy looking at a John Baldessari piece, or flip the pages of any Condé Nast magazine without confusing the editorial pictures and advertising, you're already on your way to understanding the ground rules of the new contemporary photographic narration. What is being represented is a sensibility, a generational awareness that allows for the abstractions and disjunctions inherent in photography to be dealt with quite openly. You go from the specific to the general, piecing together convincing narratives from images extracted from file cabinets of marginal sensibilities. It's what Michael Lesy did in Timelines, and it's what Carol Kaczmarek and I are trying to do as we edit a series of low-priced paperback books that'll be called The Picture Library of Everyday Life. Each volume is going to represent a photo narrative grounded in some contemporary American preoccupation. What I've got to show you is most of the spreads from the dummy of the first book, which is called I'm So Happy. What Carol Kaczmarek and I were interested in doing was taking a kind of serious look at photography out of the museum realm and, in a way, out of the art realm. So we went to Vintage Books, who's in the last couple of years has been figuring out how to get fiction out to a larger public, and we said, it's time to reinvent picture books. Let's see what we can do. So they kind of gave us the go-ahead to do the series. The first book in it is called I'm So Happy, and it's going to be coming out in November. The books are meant, as I said, not to be seen as art books, not to be seen as photography books. They're paperbacks. They're trade paperbacks. They're $12.95. They have about 100 pictures apiece. Each book is meant to use photographs in a different way. I'm So Happy was pulled together after about a year's worth of research where we looked at, I guess, close to 1 million pictures. We lost count when we passed about 600,000. We went through the whole Daily News archive. We went through the Mobil Oil archive. We went through a lot of picture agency archives. There was a terrific archive in Buffalo that had inadvertently been bought by the Mormon Church that we went through. And looking for pictures that told us about the American preoccupation with happiness and how photography tells America, gives serving suggestions on how happiness might in fact occur and what it might look like. So what I've got are our page spreads. I forgot to bring the kind of last decade of it, so this will take you up to the 1980s. It's going to be the title page. It's the title will probably float in that sea of smiling, happy heads. These are photographed from a Xerox dummy, so it'll give you an idea of what we're thinking about. A picture on the left is by Josef Karsh. It's, you know, the setup for this. It's the happy ideal world. The picture on the right comes from a file that's marked symbolic. There's lots of great symbolic files in all of these archives. The text for the book is an interesting problem. People who are involved in publishing photography books very often feel that since the market for photography books is so tiny because the market and interest group for art photography is so tiny that things have to be bolstered by a big, serious text by a famous person. When we first started talking about doing this book, there was a line in the budget to hire an important writer, and it took 2 years to get the contract even finished, and each time we went back, they would cut down the money for an important writer. So a year into it, it was a less important writer. 2 years into it, when we signed the contracts, they say, you write it. And so we thought,